Good afternoon, and we're going to call to order the State Government's Veterans Budget Division. It's Tuesday, February 12th, about 7 minutes after 3. Quorum is present. Today, members, we have 6 budget reviews that will be presented to this committee. In your package, you'll find the agenda, spreadsheet specific to the 6 jurisdictions for today, and handouts for some of the testifiers. After today, we will be about a third of the way through our reviews. And with that, we begin with Capital Area and Architectural Planning Board, Mr. Mandel and Ms. Stark. And if you two would come to the table and identify yourselves and start your presentation, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nancy Stark, and I'm the executive secretary of a very long-titled agency, the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. But you can call us the CAP Board for short.
Mandel, principal planner for the CAP Board.
We'd like to give you just a brief overview of who we are and what we do. I think many of you know us already. And Senator Rest is one of our board members. So with that, the CAP Board was established by the 1967 legislature. We are a small, independent, non-cabinet planning and regulatory agency responsible for architectural design, long-range planning, and zoning jurisdiction for the capital area. The legislature sets our boundaries, and the board's responsibilities are found in Minnesota Statute 15B. The nonpartisan board is comprised of 12 members. Public members are appointed by the governor and the mayor of St. Paul, and we have 4 legislators on the board. An advisory committee of 3 design professionals serves the board, along with 3 of us as full-time staff. We are responsible to the legislature, and the board can provide or review capital budget requests.
In December 2011, the CAP Board was one of several agencies, about a dozen, I believe, asked to prepare a report to the Sunset Advisory Commission on the efficiency and effectiveness of agency. The board, in explaining our operating procedures, identified major activity areas of Statute 15B, which is our governing statute, showed outcomes and measurements and identified costs per year for each activity. The Sunset Advisory Commission ruled last year that the CAP Board will expire then on June 30th, 2018. The CAP Board has no specific programs or activities beyond those specifically enumerated by statute. Required of all state agencies, the CAP Board participates in SWIFT and in COOP, which is the Emergency Preparedness Plans, and all agency strategies are executed and measured in keeping with the Board's mission and comprehensive plan.
The CAP Board's current and Governor's recommendation for base budget is $325,000 per fiscal year and appropriated from the general fund. I would add that this was the agency's base budget as far back as 2003. Between then and now, the agency often maintains part-time operation to stay within budget while still addressing the needs of projects, timely review of zoning matters, and assuming unfunded mandates. Though the quality of service people have come to know and expect of the board has not been compromised, the CAP Board operates a very lean state agency. However, we lack the ability to upgrade CAP Board planning tools and some equipment, and there are no funds for employee development or reward for good performance. So in conclusion, we can say that any budget reduction for the next biennium puts the CAP Board again at a point of possible part-time operation. Mr. Chair, we welcome your questions.
Are there any questions for either Ms. Stark or Mr. Mandel? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stark or Mr. Mandela, the LRT kind of added to your oversight or responsibility. How did that work out for you as far as any complications or any things that were difficult in dealing with that new responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson.
Yeah, Mr. Mandela.
Back in 1993, I had been involved. I've been here at the CAP Board since 1987, and as far back as 1991, was working on various LRT plans. So in 1993, realizing that for sure the LRT was going to come through the Capitol in some way, shape, or form, our statute was modified so that we would not be requiring design competitions, but that we, because federal dollars were involved, we would be responsible for approving all design criteria, siting, and station plans. And because federal dollars were involved, we were then reimbursed for those services because of the extensive nature of that. So it worked well. We were the keeper of the comprehensive plan, the zoning ordinance, and everything else. So it worked well to have us in that role, and because we have the longer time view, once it started in actual construction and design work, Department of Administration joined in and then was heavily involved I think it was a memorandum of understanding that they executed with Met Council. So we've worked with them, and it's worked out well.
Thank you.
Ms. Stark and Mr. Mandel, this committee has taken tour of the Capitol, kind of, you know, I realize it's not as extensive as talking with you, but we've got some idea of what our challenges are, and we appreciate the work that you do and are doing. Any other questions for the
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Metzen.
Can we visit just for briefly about what Sears is thinking of doing in that
big area that they have across the street? Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen. Sears had approached us. I'm the zoning administrator for the board, in addition to being its principal planner. They had approached us back early fall, and they have taken inventory of all their properties nationwide and are looking at 10 key properties for redevelopment, this being one of their top priorities. What they are looking at is a phased implementation of what they call liner box. They would keep the Sears building functioning and in its current location. They had approached the city to see if the city had TIF money, whether a new Sears could be built on the site and thus relinquish the old building. There being no TIF monies available, they're keeping the current Sears, and they're doing a three-phase approach that they'll be coming back to us for zoning applications. It's a mixed-use development, the first phase, and they don't have a timeline specifically, but they will be making zoning applications within the next few months for the first phase, which is a two-story commercial and office running from Marion Street along the south facade of Sears to Rice Street and cornering onto Rice. Like I said, that would be first-floor commercial, second-floor office. They'll be they're downsizing the Sears building itself and taking 10,000 square feet out of the Sears ground floor for hopefully restaurants and such. The second phase is a 100,000 square foot office building and a 550 car parking ramp that would be behind the office building, so it would be completely hidden from street view but accessed for the office building. And then the third phase, the auto body shop gets subsumed into the current Sears building, and it gets replaced by, at this point, the plan calls for 120 apartment units and 9 condominiums along Marion Street. Like I said, it's a three-phase piece, and then the south half or third, if you wish, up to the hotel would then be redeveloped based on which market took off, the residential, the office, or the commercial, at a level of assumed greater density because of the LRT and everything else.
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Mattson.
Yeah, just because the proximity and that it's on our campus, so to speak, you have to, and I'm sure you're going to, be very diligent what goes near this building, this pristine building and our grounds, and make sure that this huge project is watched over carefully and done right, and where it does fit in with our great investment here and the looks of our building and so forth and so on. So stay on your toes and do the best job you can to make sure that it's compatible to our investment here, the state's investment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mattson, we are working. We've had the architectural advisors meeting with them. The board has been in review and approved the concept plan, the initial concept plan. We're also working with the St. Paul Design Center and the City of St. Paul Planning Department on it. So design qualities and pedestrian safety and walkability is a prime concern, and then compatibility, of course, with our comprehensive plan and the surrounding area is also top priority.
Senator Rest. Oh, are you done?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, what is the most recent financial audit or internal controls and compliance audit done by the legislative auditor of your office?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, excuse me. That was back in, I believe, 04 that we had the last audit. We were approached a couple years ago to prepare for the auditor, and then that was canceled. So it has been a while.
Thank you.
Other questions for two testifiers? If not, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very informative. Next, we have Doreen Frost, Executive Director for the Accountancy Board. Yeah. And we will note that Ms. Frost is also the Executive Director of the Architecture Engineering Board and will do testifying for both these boards. So let's start out with the Accountancy Board.
All right.
Ms. Frost, identify yourself and please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Senator. My name is Doreen Frost, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy. And although I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Architecture as well, and I'll have a separate testimony for that, I do want to just give you a brief history of this board, and that is in the Board of Accountancy, because it plays into the whole budgeting cycle. The Board of Accountancy in 2004 agreed with the Board of Architecture and Engineering to combine office spaces. We were kind of lean before lean was such a common terminology up at the Capitol. And so they took two executive directors, and I'm 0.5 to each, and we share office space. We're not just in the same building. We actually share office space, and we share equipment. But first, I'm going to talk about the Board of Accountancy. Board of Accountancy was established in 1909, and to enforce 326A01 through 326.14. We are charged with making sure that the accountants, certified public accountants, that are actually operating in public practice are competent based on education, exam, and experience. We also have a very robust enforcement program in the state of Minnesota. Our CPA enforcement program for Minnesota was used as one of the models in establishing best practices with the National Association of State Board of Accountancy. We have had over 696 complaints in the last fiscal biennium. We have 9 board members that really focus on making sure that their policies are established to protect the public first and foremost, but also that they're rational and efficient as it operates a state agency. The 9 board members are appointed by the governor, and we have 3 public members to make sure that there is an objective kind of watchdog over the whole thing. In 2008, this board implemented mobility, which allowed the practice privilege right for anybody holding licenses in multiple jurisdictions where there's substantially equivalent laws on the education, exam, and experience to practice in Minnesota without either a license or the fees. And unless they were preparing financial statements or attestation work. So mobility has been a big factor and one of the reasons why we want to continue to have a strong enforcement program. We have the licensees in the state of Minnesota. Last biennium, as of June 30th, 2012, we had 17,362 individuals licensed under this board and 1,885 firms. So it's a pretty large and robust number of licensees and firms that the agency oversees. In fiscal year 11, we brought in $794,087, and we're appropriated back $505. And in fiscal year 12, it was $940 and $172, and we had an appropriation back at $480. That's the same number that's being appropriated with this governor's recommendation. I do want to disclose or to tell you that there is going to be a bill that will be coming before many of you, and that is to raise the CPA licensing fees. And although I'm not going to talk about that now, I just want to let you know that we will be asking for a raise in licensing fees. In 1909, the CPA fees were $25 a year, and in 2013, they're $45 a year. And going back at least 35 years, we've never had a fee increase. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have a staff of 3.5. And we have had numerous temporary staff as we work on a scanning project. I will sit for questions, sir.
Questions. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, of the nine board members, are any of them currently practicing CPAs?
Yes, sir. Three are public members, and the other six are our
Ms. Frost.
Oh, sorry, okay. Sir. Senator Sachsen. Sir. Yes, six are certified public accountants, and it has to be a mix under the statute of small firms and large firms, and then the three public members.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. So do you consider that a conflict of interest for that board? And we're looking at other boards forming, and I just want to get your perspective on if that's a benefit for the accounting board to have people that are currently practicing.
Ms. Frost.
Sir, members of the committee, I don't know how we could do our enforcement program without the licensees on the licensing board. For both boards, I can talk about this. Your complaint committee is made up of, in this case for the Board of Accountancy, three members. The investigators for any of the state licensing agencies, you don't need to be a chicken to recognize an egg. You can be a good investigator and follow up and understand what the statutes and rules are. But in complex, and especially in the CPA world and in the built environment, you have to have somebody with a professional expertise that can handle the enforcement program. The other reason I think it is not a conflict of interest is, for example, our board incorporates standards from the Uniform Accountancy Act. There's no way that someone who does not have that regulation background, that education background, and a current license could remain current on all of those complex measures that go into being a certified public accountant. We rely heavily on our board members, not for the processing of the licenses. We have pretty set standards, although they sign off on the licenses, but they are absolutely critical when we have difficult cases for licensure, and they're invaluable on the complaint committee and in the enforcement process.
Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill to which he's referring is my bill and be coming here. But I have, in the first committee in which the bill was presented, we referenced the percentage of licensing fees that eventually make their way into support for the Board of Accountancy, and it's certainly not all of it. Okay, I noticed in the governor's recommendation that even though the bill calls for additional fees with the assumption that at least the same percentage of that addition will be used to support another investigator and being part of the uniform, I don't know what all the letters were, but the database that is part of the Uniform Accountancy Act across the country. But I noticed in the governor's, in the budget book, that there's no recommendation from him for any increase to support the Board of Accountancy. And I was wondering what kind of conversations you've had with the governor and if they would be supportive of this fee increase and at least a portion of those dollars not going into the general fund for general purposes, but for the support of the additional work for enforcement and being part of that database, which Mr. Chairman is an attempt to make sure that the public has access to actions taken by the board with regard to CPAs as they are, you know, looking to see if anybody's being disciplined and so forth. So where is the governor with regard to that bill at this point? And have you spoken to him since he or his staff since he recommended no change in your budget?
Ms. Frost.
Thank you, Senator and members of the committee, and Senator Rest. In the past year, they did not have an issue with us on the fees. We needed to raise the fees in order to ask for more full-time equivalent staff. Let me just tell you that we work closely with Minnesota MMB, mm-hmm. And they have advised us that she signed off on the fiscal note. They're aware of it, and they also realize that more money goes into the general fund. At the time when we didn't do a change order because we weren't generating enough money to support additional staffing. So we're kind of in a catch-22. The House added an amendment to that bill mm-hmm. that would have it start the date of enactment, and also that's going to change the fiscal note both in the House and the Senate, asking for the additional appropriations in this cycle. I have not yet had a chance to follow up with their staff.
So I'm trying to understand if that's a yes or a no. Mr. Chairman, so the governor or MMB in general would be supportive of the fee increase and supportive of an increase in the Board of Accountancy's budget to support those designated activities. Is that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We got there.
Okay, great. Other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frost, I take it that the Board of Accountancy is part of a larger national group that other states have, similar situation where you have different officers or different staff people that participate in events like that. How do we compare with other states as far as the Board of Accountancy, and I don't know how you would classify, rank them or things like that? But
Ms. Frost.
Senator Anderson, I think we're one of the best. No, all kidding aside, and I mean it all kidding aside, our board members are extremely active at the National Association of State Board of Accountancy, as well as me as a staff member. They are involved in helping establish these policies across the country. I just recently came off of a three-year commitment on my volunteer time to the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants dealing with exam issues. Minnesota has a reputation of being there and fully participating. They're not off on a boondoggle in any way. And I have to tell you, they're basically volunteers with a per diem of $55 an event and some mileage. I'm always humbled by how much work goes into this kind of service. And I think the CPAs that volunteer to serve on this board or request service on this board are in positions to realize how significant regulation is and the problems when it goes amok, and they are very dedicated. So, and I was kind of wanted to make light of it, but Minnesota is highly regarded, and our standards are used. Does that mean we don't have areas of improvement? Absolutely. But we adopted mobility. We're trying to make these changes to the UAA, and I think the biggest thing is we also have a very strong enforcement program that means business when you violate the statutes and rules, and it's not just pursuing unlicensed practice.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Frost, do you have any type of I know that we get publications and things that come in the mail talking about different – do you have anything like that on a national basis where they would send out information about you along with the rest of the accountancy boards?
Ms. Frost.
Thank you, Senator Soxhawk and Senator Anderson. The National Association of State Board of Accountancies has a robust budget, and if they, we can do searches all the time, and they will, they prepare reports at the request of the various states and during legislative need time. So there's a national, they have national databases. One of the things that Senator Ann Rest was referring to is when you have enforcement action, especially after mobility, that enforcement action just doesn't get posted in our newsletter and on the website. We report all enforcement action, especially more critical than ever with mobility, is that all enforcement action is reported to a national database. That national database, for example, is maintained by the National Association of State Board of Accountancy. The Mobility Act also put us in a position where citizens need to know that that if I'm licensed as a certified public accountant in one state and I'm suddenly over there doing just a small project, where is that person licensed? They don't know where to go. That is called CPA Verify, which will list on a timely basis all active CPAs to the date, so that if a CPA has their license revoked, somebody could report that. Minnesota cannot yet participate in that because there's a cost to getting into that database, connecting our system to their system, and that's one of the reasons why we'll be asking for a fee increase to do the computer upgrade on that with the approval of Minute.
Other questions? If not, Ms. Frost, you want to continue as you put on your other hat, and please proceed.
Senator, we do have a handout, and that's just for an ease of an overview of the seven professions that are under a single board. This board is architecture, engineering, land surveying, landscape architecture, geology, soil science, and certified interior designers. This board was established in 1921. It has 21 board members, so much, much different than the 9 board members on the Board of Accountancy. The reason being is there are board members representing each of those professions and 5 public members. This board it's different in many, many ways. There are 2 standalone boards, as I indicated earlier. We have 18,800 licensees on this board. We have a much higher amount of outstate applicants that come in for single jobs, for example, under comedy applications. We meet our mission, again, by protection of the public through the education, the exam, and the experience, and again, then the enforcement process. The board's fees come in every 2 years. In fiscal year 11, we brought in $679, and our appropriation was $815,000, so we were in the hole, because the fiscal year 12 is when we bring in the majority of the money, and we brought in $2,000,000. 81 and 145, and we are appropriated back 774. This board is very active both on a national level as well as a state level. Again, very dedicated board members. The complaint numbers are always lower. I'm not sure why, but they tend to be more complex. We had 171 complaints in the last fiscal year. When we get complaints in this arena, it tends to involve multiple layers of plans or sometimes crossovers in the various professions. Each of these professions has a separate set of administrative rules for the guidelines on the education and the enforcement, and, of course, they have the statutory authority. With the last profession coming on, which was geoscience, which is the geology and soil science, in 1996. Mr. Chair, I will sit for questions.
Questions. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A similar question of the people that are on the board as an architect or an engineering, land surveying, landscape architecture, are any of them presently practicing? And if so, is that a conflict of interest?
Yes. Ms. Frost.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, everybody but the 5 public members are one of the licensed professions. In this board, what is critically important is under their definition, they have to have progressive engineering experience, for an example, and the 5 professional engineers actually have to sit down and help us evaluate what is progressive engineering experience in all of the various disciplines. They spend more time, for example, looking at the applications after they're all bundled together. We need those professional engineers to help evaluate whether that experience is sufficient to protect the public health, safety, and welfare. And again, they have 5 members on their complaint committee. I just left one this morning, and every one of those professionals had files bundled up for them ready to review with the report. And we need them to look at the plans to, say, go out and get, for example, land surveying. It's just not the plat. It's the field notes that we may need. They need their technical expertise to assist us in making a determination whether or not there is a need for enforcement and at what level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the members, it's just we have another major bill coming through the exchange, and yet we're excluding health insurance companies and agents from the boards, and they are the experts. And I just want to make the case, just make the comment and move on.
Senator Gazalka, I kind of assume that that's what you're getting at. Ms. Frost, when we're talking about enforcement, on this particular board, could you discuss that a little bit?
The enforcement, well, first of all, it's only been a few years ago that you increased the civil penalty for unlicensed practice in the state of Minnesota. Our complaints come in with the guidance of 214, so we get them both from the public as well as from other practitioners. And it can be anywhere from holding out without a license to misconduct, incompetency, negligence, just poor practice in general or bad business practices that get them in trouble. We do not get involved in anything that has the ability that's just a fee dispute or a contract dispute. Those aren't cases that we can pursue, but we do pursue quite a few that have to do with competency, continuing education, as well as just general practices.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Ms. Frost, do your different boards here interact with the other agencies, such as professional engineering with the Department of Transportation or geologists with the Department of Natural Resources, and are you just a board that gives advice, or do you actually have people that work hand in hand to come up with solutions to some of the problems that I'm always hearing about problems in the DNR and problems in the Department of Transportation, and I don't hear these here people being involved with them at all, but maybe there are.
Ms. Frost, any comment on that? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our licensees are in a lot of those professions, so I'm not sure what kind of complaints that you actually hear, but let me just say globally, let's go for the Department of Labor and Industry, which has the code officials, or the Department of Health that oversees a lot of the components. It is not uncommon. One of the reasons we went to an e-licensing system before e-licensing was mandated was that so code officials could actually look up and find out if somebody's licensed and what their area of practice is and come to us if there was a particular problem. We also work with the Department of Health along those same lines, and our licensees are in many of those divisions. Now, work to solve problems if we're aware of them? Yes, we do, and we do comment on each other's rules and so forth. But again, we have a staff of 6.5, so or 7 now, I guess. We are aware of it, and we do work with other agencies. And I'm not sure what other components you mean. I also go to the medical boards group just to see what's happening, so that we're not just acting and operating, you know, without any input from other agencies.
Other questions for Ms. Frost? Thank you for your presentations.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it.
Thank you for the privilege.
Now we have the Board of Barber Examiners, Thora Fisco. Hi.
Hi.
If you could identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
All right.
Nice to see you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, my name is Thora Fisco, and I am the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners. I've been with the board since 2010, and I thank you for this opportunity to share with you an overview of the board's activities and the governor's budget recommendations. The board takes its statutory authority from Chapter 154, and the board's mission is to promote public health and safety by assuring that barbers are appropriately trained, demonstrate the skills necessary to conduct barbering services in safe, sanitary, and appropriate environments, and we do this through barber education, licensing, and inspection activities. The board is committed to public protection, and we also are supportive of the barbering profession. The board consists of four members, three of whom are licensed barbers and one public member. We meet six times per year in open public session, and it is very common to have several barbers in the room just to hear what's happening and or to comment with the board. The board also maintains a complaint committee, which meets 5 to 6 times per year, and we process 10 to 15 complaints per year. Complaints to the board are typically related to the two big ones are unlicensed activity and sanitation violations, and often they go hand in hand. The board licenses, we have approximately 3,300 licenses that include 5 schools, 16 instructors, approximately 100 student barbers, 200 apprentice barbers, 2,100 registered barbers, and about 900 barber shops across the state. And those licenses are annual, so they are renewed annually. The board employs 3 full-time employees to manage our licensing and inspection and compliance process. We have a customer service specialist who is available to barbers and the public to answer questions, assist with application processes. She does process applications and issue licenses also. The board has a steady stream of foot traffic. It's many of the barbers in the metro area like to come to us in person to do their business. So we see a lot of the barbers on an annual basis as they renew. Yeah. Our customer service specialist is there to help them through that process. We have one inspector to inspect the shops across the state, and we strive to inspect shops on an 18-month rotation so that every shop is inspected no less than once every 2 years. Our inspector also works with us to do investigations when necessary related to the complaint process or when we have compliance issues. And then there's myself as executive secretary who oversees board activities, manages the staff. I work very closely in the complaint process, etc. The board is funded by the general fund, and the government's proposal continues the board's current budget of $257,000 per year. And we bring in revenues of approximately $289,000 per year. That's the average over the last biennium. And so about 11% of our revenues actually remain in the general fund. I'll stand for questions.
Ms. Fisco, how many barbers are there and how many barber shops?
There are approximately 900 barber shops, and there are 2,100 master barbers and about 200 apprentice barbers.
Okay, and Ms. Fisco, do you see any trends in the barbering industry in terms of, have you seen an increase decrease?
We're actually seeing a modest increase. Okay. It's been slow but sure. In barber shops, I would say in the years that I've been there, we've seen maybe 30 more shops. So it's not a lot, but there is slow growth.
And some of this to do with franchising, or what's happened over the last?
We don't see a lot of the franchising. It's a lot of individuals opening small 1 and 2 chair shops.
I see. Okay. Other questions for Ms. Fisco? Not. Thank you very much. We appreciate you copying your presentation.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to do the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. And the executive director, who's with us today, Mr. Paul Erickson. Mr. Erickson, if you'd Identify yourself and, okay. and go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Erickson, Executive Director of Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. First of all, I'd like to recognize two former Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission board members from the Senate, Senator Ann Rest, who I had the opportunity to play a round of golf once with, and then also Senator Metzen, who I saw just step out. Our staff put together this booklet, and if I could use this as kind of the walkthrough, because I know there's a few new members on the committee, I think that would help tell the Amateur Sports Commission story. So, Mr. Chairman, first of all, page through it, agency mission. Governor Rudy Perpich had an idea back in 1984 that Minnesota could play a role in if we established high-quality amateur sports facilities and developed accompanying programs, that we would draw people from other states. And prior to Governor Perpich's time, Minnesota got about $10 million of out-of-state money from visiting amateur athletes. And after the investment of the legislature of the facilities like the National Sports Center in Blaine, the speed skating facility in Roseville, we now average $70 million a year, and it comes in every year. And it's an industry that's clean, it's non-polluting, and it also is relatively recession-proof, as you'll see in a minute. So the mission of the Sports Center was to develop high-quality amateur sports facilities and programs that would bring out-of-state tourism dollars to Minnesota. And once these facilities built, they'd also be great for Minnesota families to recreate in. So if you keep turning a couple pages, you'll see four graphs. The first graph on the left is statewide impact, and that's the $70 million dollars a year. And then you'll see that there's a little over 5 million annual visitors to these facilities statewide. There's the National Sports Center in Blaine, which is our flagship facility, and then there's 10 facilities statewide, which are listed in this report. Now, you notice there is a trend. There is a little bit, you know, good news and not so good news. Since the recession, this has flattened out. But interesting, can you imagine this chart for the housing industry and the auto industry? Of what the recession did. And I think you'll find, Senators, is that amateur sports is a relatively recession-resistant industry. I wouldn't say it's recession-proof, but you can imagine if you have a daughter or a son in figure skating or hockey, during tough times, are you going to say, honey, let's take Susie out of figure skating? Not likely, because we sacrifice for our children. And I think you'll find that the state's investment in amateur sports has been a very solid one, and it's somewhat recession-resistant, as you'll see by these charts. Now, the second side of just the National Sports Center, with the reduction over the last 10 years of Amateur Sports Commission staff, at one time, years ago, we had 7-8 staff, we're down to 3. And you know, as you know, we've tightened our belt like the rest of state government. It's almost reduced most of our activity to helping and working with the National Sports Center and not driving to Rochester for the Volleyball Center, not driving, you know, to Coleraine to work with the ski jump people. Because even today, I don't know if you guys realize this, but in our budget, we have no money for travel. So if I choose to travel to Marshall and visit the proposed project we have with Senator Dame, it's my own nickel if I go to Rochester, because that's been wiped out the last 3 or 4 years. And so it's a rather frugal operation. We do we have some board members like Joel Carlson who donates. He doesn't take any per diem because he knows the condition of the agency. But so I think what you see a little bit of a trend here, Mr. Chairman, is that the statewide facilities are really flat or going down a little bit in impact, but where we spend a lot of our time in Blaine, we have growth through the recession. And you notice the charts for both economic impact and attendance. The National Sports Center in Blaine is outperforming the recession. If you turn a couple pages, you'll see some narrative on the National Sports Center. It's the world's largest soccer complex with over 50 fields. It's the world's largest ice arena complex with 8 sheets under one roof. And I want to give another fun fact I think that the members would appreciate. The Schwann Super Rink is a $24 million asset. The state's total investment in that facility is $1 million. It was 4 Mighty Ducks grants in the first part of that program. That facility was put together I like to think creatively with a joint powers agreement with 10 cities and 2 counties, but yet the state is getting that benefit of all those big tournaments. And so I think you'll find our agency is very entrepreneurial in really stretching the state investment into ways that we get a much greater return on investment with a smaller investment. So paging through, you'll see the statewide facilities. This report is going to be expanded upon later in the session, and you'll all get a copy where we have a couple pages on the Bush Lake Ski Jump, Giants Ridge, the John Rose Oval in Roseville, and National Volleyball Center, and so on. But for the sake of this early report, we just list the facilities here. The other thing I want to mention is that if you go now to the grant programs, there are two bills that are recommending the revitalization of the Mighty Ducks Ice Arena grant program. Minnesota has two issues with ice arenas, and we're kind of leading the nation on this issue. Air quality, we need some resources to help communities solve their air quality problem. And then half of our arenas, or a little over half, have the old Freon 22, which the federal government has now banned. And so there's going to be, in the next 10 years, those facilities need to be upgraded. So we're not going to talk about that today, but you'll see those bills that are going to try to help those issues down the road. And notice that the tradition of our agency's grant making is that we've done a good job of giving the grants statewide, so every congressional district always benefited, and so on. So in closing, I would just like to say, you notice the budget is approximately $250,000 a year, state general fund money. We were hovering around 270, but in the last several years, that was cut back. That's where we lost a lot of our, you know, like travel reimbursement money and so on. And just so you know, we faced the possibility of losing our third staff person. But I want to give you another example of the creativity of the agency. We noticed that when you as legislature approved the Minnesota Twins project, Hennepin County established a grant program. Hennepin County did not have a grant-making department, so we proposed that the Amateur Sports Commission be contracted by the county, and so we administer about $2 million a year for Hennepin County, and our agency gets $40,000-$50,000 a year, and so we're able to retain that third staff. So, Mr. Chairman, I think using two examples, like how the Schwann Super Rink was built with a minimum state dollars, and how our state agency is contracting services to a Minnesota county. And currently, and I'd appreciate your encouragement, we're presenting to the Minnesota Office of Grants. There's apparently 25, 30 different organizations in state government that do grant making. We're proposing that we offer our services to other state agencies so that we can maintain this intellectual, you know, capability that we have in grant making. I will say that, you know, our agency, hope I'm not speaking out of school, you know, did recommend a slight increase so that we could maintain, you know, travel reimbursement, things like that. And the governor has chosen to keep state government at a very, you know, belt-tightening circumstance. And we certainly want to be team players, but it does make life a little awkward at times. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to report to you that the agency continues successfully on what you as legislature set us up to do, is bring out-of-state dollars. You can see by the performance proof that that's still occurring with less staff. You also established us to oversee the National Sports Center. It's operated in the black without city, county, or state operating subsidy since 1991. And so we believe we're accomplishing our mission. We're good stewards of the public assets that you have granted to us. So with that, I'll offer to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Erickson? Senator, how are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I was looking through the grant programs, and I see that you have it broken down by congressional district.
Correct.
And so I would like to understand, or if you could just elaborate on how you determine, what body decides who gets the grants. So that's really what I'm looking for.
Okay.
Mr. Erickson.
Yep. Senator Champion and Mr. Chairman. The agency governance established by the legislature, we have six legislative appointees, three from the Senate, three from the House, and then there's 11 gubernatorial appointees. That group is the decider of where grants go. The process is that we publish an RFP. All Minnesota cities, school districts, and counties are encouraged to apply. Almost all of our programs are matching, like with our Ice Arena grant program. An Ice Arena costs $3 million. A community could get up to $250,000, so the state share is quite small. Anyway, so staff does an evaluation of all of the applicants. The board generally has appointed a committee of five or six members. The members then review the staff recommendations, and the committee of the commission brings it to the full board, and they make the final approval. And that's how all of those grants have been made over those years.
Senator Champion, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? I guess, Mr. Erickson, I realize you kind of told us what maybe the potential was for expansion, but, you know, whether it's contractual work or grant making, but in terms of what's been accomplished, if you look out the next number of years, is there some things that you think could be accomplished, either with more money or just your idea of what should happen? The sports.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, thank you for that opportunity. I'll try to be brief. But first of all, I want the members to understand that when we contract our services to a county or city to do grant making or another state agency, those staff then are saving the state money, but they're not doing amateur sports work for the statewide mission. They're simply being hired to work for Hennepin County for that period. So it's good in one sense, bad in the other. So that leads me to one thing. I think that the legislature never intended this to be the Metro Amateur Sports Commission or the Blaine. It's the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. And for us to truly fulfill the mission, to have a little bit of travel expense so that we're encouraged to go to a Marshall and to a Rochester, is that a little additional resources would be very helpful. The other thing on that end, there are some regions of the state that have not benefited. That we have no facilities in southwest Minnesota. We have a high-quality proposal for Marshall, Minnesota, that Senator Dames is aware of. And so that our vision is that we want to at least have a presence, and we do in southeast through Rochester. Southwest would be Marshall. We have, you know, Coleraine and Giants Ridge in northeast. And we have a proposal for Moorhead for a facility. I think if with a little additional staff and a capital investment in the regions, then I think the vision that Rudy Perpich had of a statewide agency promoting amateur sports would be realized by having, you know, those good facilities in all four corners of the state and a little bit more staff support. But with that, you know, I've been around here. You know, I started here as a brunette, Mr. Chairman, and I'm silver-haired now, and I realize that when all state government tightens the belt, you know, the Amateur Sports Commission is not going to take priority over K through 12 education and nursing homes. So we understand that we tighten our belt with everyone else, but I'm obligated to tell you that with a little additional resource, the state would get its resource back in spades because of what we've been able to do these last 20 years.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, you've got these charts here showing like Buffalo and Monticello in Congressional District 2, and yet they are in Congressional District 6, and I'm just wondering how were these charts put together and just left as to when they were given several years ago or what?
Mr. Erickson.
Senator Anderson, Mr. Chairman, we used the Congressional District at that time. So when those grants were made, those cities were in those congressional districts. I know there's been some changes since that time, but rather than putting them in the current congressional district, someone might say, so we felt just for the sake of our sense of organization that we did it that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Erickson for bringing up the Marshall Project. For those that haven't seen anything on it, it's a beautiful project, and as the session goes on, well, you'll be hearing more about that project, and hopefully we'll be able to get that project moved through this year.
Senator Deems, in less than 25 words, is it an ice arena or a basketball arena or volleyball?
It's going to be a sports facility, be built in Marshall, and then maybe Paul can allude a little more as to what all will be in the sports center.
Yeah, Mr. Hicks, we'd be interested.
One way to describe it is that the National Sports Center has, you know, ice and fields and other spaces. It's a mini Blaine. And the thing that Marshall has had to vision is the high school campus is adjacent to the state university, and this facility is between the two. So if they have a major, you know, ice hockey tournament, they use all of those. They have a major field soccer or lacrosse. They have a major basketball, volleyball. And so it really augments, you know, the existing facilities. You know, I know that you as legislators, when I've been on tours, get frustrated by, and you travel around the state, that the high school and the college are not working together. Well, believe me, if anywhere in Minnesota, this community is all working as one. And so this facility would be an asset to the state university, an asset to the high school, and an asset to the state's mission to promote amateur sports. There's a huge amateur sports market in Sioux Falls. They're building facilities like crazy there, hockey rinks and so on. So when Marshall hosts tournament, they'd bring in that South Dakota money, that Nebraska money, and that North Dakota money. They would be our regional hub, just as Rochester's doing that in volleyball in Southeast, bringing in those Wisconsin and Iowa dollars.
Sounds like a good project. Senator Stumpf, I'm
Thank
sure
you,
be, be interested in it. Yep. Any other questions for Mr. Erickson? Not. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Appreciate
Chairman.
It. Last but not least, the Humanities Center, David O'Fallon and Trista Matias Castillo. Yeah, could you give us just a couple of seconds? I think we'll move that screen over so
right
that Senator Rest and Senator Anderson will have an easier time seeing it. Senator Anderson, is that better?
Yep.
Okay.
I don't know about for Senator Rust.
Senator Rust, how are you doing?
It's all right.
It's okay. All right. Mr. O'Fallon, if those testifying would identify themselves and proceed. Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. David O'Fallon, I'm the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and with me is my director of information, Tian. Would you introduce yourself?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tian Nguyen August, and I'm the Director of Information and Technology at the Humanities Center.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Trista Mattis Castillo. I lead the Women Veterans Initiative for Minnesota, but I'm partnering with the Humanities Center on a project that we'll tell you about shortly.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. O'Fallon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We prepared a 95-minute PowerPoint for your amusement this afternoon, but we've cut it back. I want to share with you the mission of the center a little bit and then briefly the work that we're doing. I know today's an overview. The center is about 40 years old. We exist in state statute, and we operate as a nonprofit organization. You'll see a PowerPoint going up behind us. The mission is to build a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society, which we take, really, we think one of the great challenges right now is very simple. It's a pretty complicated world. How are we all going to get along with each other? Fundamentally, that's the work of the Humanities Center. To the next one. Is a difference to some of the organizations that have just testified. We don't license anybody. We don't certify anybody. We have basically no authority to close or open a shop of any kind. So people work with us because they find something valuable, and I'm pleased to have you note that 100,000 people in over 200 different communities have worked extensively with us this past couple of years. And our primary work is in education. If you want to look at the state map, we are, in fact, all over the state of Minnesota. Those flags are where we've had real programs, real exhibits, partnerships, collaborations. We don't put a flag up there if I drove through town once and had lunch with the Rotary Club or something like that. This is an actual engagement over some period of time for some kind of significant result, helping people connect with each other. Go to the next one. So here's a couple of core statements from us, and I just want you to know we're focused on the future of Minnesota. It's a time of a lot of changes going on, as our testifiers before us just talked about. We are trying to build relationships that connect us rather than divide us. It's a primary value of every piece of work we do at the center. I know it might sound like 10,000 feet, but we mean it in fact, and every program is informed by that. And we have a special affinity for bringing into public life and public education the stories of people that have been left out or marginalized or not heard at all. I think that's a core value, and we work our best to make sure that that's true. We have a lot of special programs and I think a powerful initiative for looking at K-12 education, and we'll talk a little bit more of that in a few minutes. And then I think fundamentally everybody's interested in the economy, but we think one of the primary things underlying a strong economy are strong communities of people. So we try to invest in that and build that and can share more information as the session goes on about that, too. Go to the next one. That's that one.
Senator Champion.
Before you move slides, I see that, Mr. O'Connor, perhaps that you can help us understand the legacy funds. I see that you, I suggested that you all are getting $3.1 million and that four state funds have leveraged 2 years support from the legacy fund. So can you tell me what the legacy fund represents?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I'd be very happy to talk about the legacy funding in some detail if you'd like. In fact, in your handouts, I believe we also have a distribution of the legacy funding. I think we included that in this. And maybe I didn't include that because I wasn't state GovOps support. I wasn't prepared to do that. But I can give you the fundamental breakdown of that if you'd like, and then I'm prepared to come back and discuss that at some in some detail when you'd like.
Senator Champion.
Maybe, Mr. O'Fallon, that I can sort of narrow down my question.
Of course.
And the $3.1 million, does that also represent $1 million that was given to the Humanities Center that was earmarked, for lack of a better word, for the Councils of Color?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, there was $1 million in the legislation of the last legacy funding in a piece of legislation that contained the following language for competitive grants to and cooperation with the state councils of color.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that in mind, can you be a little more specific? So I know in the past, legacy dollars would flow to the respective councils of color at a rate of $250,000 each, where their respective boards could then determine based on their community where those funds would go. So now can you explain to us if that process is still the same, or who would be making the determination as pertains to that $1 million that was at one time being used for councils of color?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, the money is absolutely used for the councils of color. The process, as I understood it this time, in consultation with the councils and with the Attorney General's office and with the Minnesota Management and Budget, because the legislative language included the words for competitive grants to and in collaboration with, we set up a process, an RFP process, so each council did in fact have to write a proposal for their use of the money, which was reviewed by an independent review body, which was selected in consultation, in fact, with the councils. So the independent review body reviewed the programs and the plans from every council and then awarded the funds.
Senator Jambi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Fallon, just so that I have some level of clarity, so the funds that were that was initially going to councils of color was placed with the Humanities Center, you all put together an RFT, and there was an independent body that was used in order to determine what, if any, money would go to the respective councils. And if that's right, I would like you to tell me if I'm right as far as that process. Can you also then also tell me who makes up the independent body?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, one point of clarification. The funding, as I understand it, and I've been at the Humanities Center 2 years, but going back several legislative sessions, when the Legacy Fund was first established, the funding for the Councils of Color was always sent through the Minnesota Humanities Center. So this wasn't a new change, but it was always done through that. The wrinkle this time was that the language, which we didn't create, which was written by the legislature, was the language that I'm trying to quote, competitive grants to for collaboration with. So that's when we did the RFP process so that, in fact, we could in good faith say there was, in fact, a review process of some kind. The independent review panel included the following people, which I'm doing from memory, Senator, so forgive me. It included Archie Givens, the president of the Givens Foundation. It included former superintendent of schools, Bill Green. It included Eric Takashita, who's a representative of a national consulting firm on learning and community. It included John Day, an Ojibwe tribal registered member on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Duluth. And it included Sandy Augustine, who's was a former executive director of Intermedia Arts and well steeped in community building through arts and culture.
Senator Thompson, yes. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. O'Fallon, can you tell me, based on the process that is now a competitive process, where you would send out an RFP and the Council of Color would have to compete for money that they at one time was given in order to have a competitive process in the respective communities. Can you please share with us which particular councils of color ended up getting the money and how much? And lastly, did the Humanities Center receive any extra revenue for overseeing those funds?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Champion, so the awards were made. Again, I want to be very clear. The RFP was written in response to needs established in collaboration with each council. So it was not as if somebody said, well, here's what we think you should do in the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, for example. So the idea was to remember the odd language in the legislation, competitive grants to for collaboration with. So to back up your questions, the Humanities Center received no extra funding for this at all. In fact, for every one of the projects, we actually invest money from other funds at the Humanities Center in collaboration and in partnership with the councils to carry out programs that they considered their top priorities.
Senator Champion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
In the interest of time, I would not go any further into detail around this issue, but as this body can glean or extract from my question, that I'm deeply concerned about the legislation, the process, and the role that the Humanities Center participated in when it came to that language and how those funds were eventually used. And so without any further ado, I just wanted to be very clear. I wanted to make sure that certain information was placed on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we have some discussions about their budget in the future, that I hope that we could have a thorough discussion about what should happen.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Rest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Champion. I'm not willing to let it go right now. and I do have, and I would recommend to you, the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the Minnesota Humanities Center which took in, it was an internal controls and compliance audit, July 1st, 2009 through February 29th, 2012. And with some of these other agencies, like I asked first of whatever board it was, they haven't had an audit since 2004. But some agencies that will come before us have. And the language that Mr. O'Fallon quoted from memory, but it's certainly paraphrased here, does indeed say that the Minnesota Humanities Center collaborated with the Councils of Color to provide competitive grants for community events and programs that celebrate and preserve artistic, historical, and cultural heritage. With regards to the arts and cultural heritage expenditures by organization for the fiscal years 2010 through 2011, in the startup year, there were dollars that were less in fiscal year 2010 due to planning and development. But in 2010, there were $27,717 for the Council of Color. In 2011, it was $222,283 for the Councils of Color. And it there were similar amounts. Actually, the Council on Black Minnesotans, that was just them, Council on Black Minnesotans received the most of any of the councils of color, but all of them, the four, ranged from $193,000 to $222,000. And I would recommend this report to you with regard to those expenditures. The OLA report found general compliance, but there were two findings. Mr. O'Fallon, and I am curious as to whether they have been resolved.
Mr. O'Fallon, so do you recognize the report? And
he signed the response letter. I hope he does.
Mr. O'Fallon, go ahead and respond.
I do recognize the report. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. I do, and I don't have the report in front of me, but I certainly will respond to the two findings, which I believe, if I recall, one was a final report from one of our grantees was late. Right. I believe that's true.
Yes.
And I think the other was somebody looked like they took a trip, and maybe they billed us twice for the trip or billed somebody twice for the trip. Are those the two items?
There were an over-reimbursement for mileage. Yes,
right.
Indeed.
And in
has that
each
been paid back?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
To further elaborate on those, we were in a bit of an odd position. And as Senator Champion has correctly pointed out, I thought that the Humanities Center was both, a good steward of the funds, and we were in an awkward financial position because we were basically told, you will give legacy money to the following organizations, and we expect you to be accountable for it. And we expect you to work in partnership and collaboration. And my general takeaway on this, and I'll respond more to the auditor's findings in just a second, I would honestly say to the committee and you'd be welcome to talk to members of any one of the councils, Senator Champion or anybody else, I honestly think the collaboration between the Humanities Center and the councils led to projects of real significance in education and in cultural development across the state. And I'd be happy to go into great detail on that at another time. I don't have all that information in front of me. To the two findings in the auditor's report, we were given in the last session basically some money to support children's museums, not the one in St. Paul, which had its own line, but three others across the state. So those museums expected, and we did the same thing with them. A competitive panel of museum professionals reviewed their proposals according to set standards and guidelines. And then we issued the money, and we then expected the final reports to come in, and one was late. And we did, in fact, get the final report eventually. And in terms of the mileage piece, the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans didn't document one trip. So perhaps that person, I think we actually got the reimbursement back, or we turned it over to the council to get the reimbursement back. I would say those are the two findings out of the Office of Legislative Auditor, which budgeted 300 hours to review our agency.
Mr. Chairman. In the finding, it indicates that by July 2012 from that particular organization, and it doesn't identify it, that received the final report, but no other supporting documentation. In that period since July of 2012, have you forwarded to the OLA the supporting documentation for that $200,000 grant?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I'd have to check with my chief financial officer. I know we have visited the, it is one of the children's museums. We've collected more information. I think we forwarded it, but I don't want to absolutely claim that we did.
And Mr. Chairman, with regard to the mileage reimbursement, you know, a good program of internal controls would have caught that right from the beginning. So I hope that you do now have in place a good internal control system that so that someone, even by mistake, is stopped at the gate from applying for an inappropriate reimbursement. And it's not a matter of how much. It's a matter of you need the internal controls, and it needs to happen in small agencies as well as in large agencies. So please know that some of us care a lot about these things, and we will bring them up with every agency for which we have a more recent. 2003 is kind of way back, but 2012 is right now.
Okay. Senator Champion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that I clarified something, because after the inquiry from my great colleague, which I think was appropriate, I just wanted to make sure that the record was clear and give Mr. O'Fallon a chance to indicate if I'm wrong about this. But I just want to be clear that when the change happened from the legislature that allowed for the $1 million to go to humanities as opposed to the way it was originally set up, which is for the councils of color to receive the appropriation, or even if it went through humanities, it went directly to each council of color. Each council of color was charged with the awesome responsibility through its board to do their RFPs to their respective communities and, by way of a competitive grant process. And that competitive grant process also required them to make every dot every I, cross every T as it pertains to the criteria, money that was spent, you know, and present that to the auditor and everyone else at the time that they were supposed to. The only reason why I'm raising this is because the challenge at the time that was articulated about the councils of color was simply that they were taking too long to give out the grants because they were over-scrutinizing the people who was coming to them in order to make sure that they could get the documentation that they were supposed to have. That was the major issue. Not that they were releasing it and someone not turning in their receipts or any of that. But it was of concern to me because once this process happened, instead of the Humanities Center being put in a place where they could work with the councils of color to build their capacity and just to make sure that the information was being done in a timely way, this change occurred, and now these same councils of color had to compete for the very funds in order to even just make sure that their communities could receive their revenue. So I just wanted to make sure I put that in context, and I just appreciate your indulging me.
And I understand what you're saying, Senator Champion. I don't know if it in terms of the Humanities Commission, if that – I mean, it isn't their fault that they were charged with that particular job. So, but your point is well taken. Senator Rest, did you have something else to say?
No, I'm done.
All right, let's continue on then, Mr. O'Fallon.
If Mr. Chair, if I may be allowed to make one more response to the absolutely legitimate concerns of Senator Champion, very briefly.
Go ahead.
Which is simply to clarify that in the first rounds, the councils did not do competitive grants out to their communities. Some did, some did not. Some invested in a single major program in collaboration with the Humanities Center. So it was really up to the councils whether they wanted to re-grant money, use it for a program, a community festival, a listening tour across the state, or what have you. So I just wanted to be clear. Councils went different directions.
So, go ahead, Mr. O'Fallon.
So then, just briefly to continue, I want you to know that the funds that are available have been used well, I believe. The fact is that we are involved with the National Endowment for the Humanities. We are their state agency, so you can see the federal government appropriation, which follows the state appropriation. We've talked at length about the legacy funds, and I would be happy at any point to come back and talk more about that, to be clear and effective, if we may. Shall we go to the next slide? We're working towards what we call common goals across the state. Minnesota has a huge education goal, and again, I would say in cooperation with the councils themselves and many other communities across the state, we've developed an education strategy that addresses one of the state's top needs and goals, which is kids from all over the world are now in every community across the state and in every school. How do teachers and kids connect? And without going into detail, we think we have a strong, research-based, well-proven program that helps kids and teachers connect, and it's effective, and it works. And that's the way we're investing a lot of our funds and money. And then, frankly, the next slide is Minnesota's changing. You know this, but just FY, in case some reminders, so-called minorities accounted for 80% of Minnesota's growth. The fastest-growing population is the Latino population. You can see the data up there for yourself. So, to go to the next slides, we're working on fundamental literacy using multiple languages, creating early learning texts that deal with people from the Hmong community and Somali communities and others across the state. So that we can address this fundamental need of connection and to notice that culture is a strength and the multiple cultures are an asset to be built upon, not a problem to be solved. And to this spirit of recognizing voices that have been left out or marginalized, we have an emerging program which I would like to ask Trista to present.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chairman.
Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm very excited to talk about a program and a partnership with the Humanities Center, and that is what we're calling the Veterans Voices Program. It is a collaboration of many veterans organizations. As you know, veterans, we're a unique culture. I know Senator Anderson, as a veteran himself, knows that we speak our own language, we celebrate our own customs and traditions, and oftentimes we as veterans are misunderstood in our communities, and vice versa. We often misunderstand civilians, if you will, in our communities. And so this was really thought up in the idea by one of the board members of the Humanities Center, Corinda, who is also a National Guard veteran, a Desert Storm veteran, that said, you know, in all of this work we're doing, the voice that's missed is and left out is that of the veteran. And so it transpired there. The Humanities Center really listened to that and stepped up and invited a group of different veteran organizations together, about 40 different organizations of every race, creed, color, age, and conflict or service time, and said, what is it that we're going to do? How can we share our voice in the community to make Minnesota understand who we are as a culture, what we have to contribute, and vice versa, and how we can work together? And so we have created a program co-chaired by myself and former Senator Ted Daley, which is the Veteran Voices Program, where we are going to recognize the 25 veterans under the age of 40 who have come back from their service and contributed to society and culture, and to really honor and lift up those veterans and what they're doing in a way to collaborate, to share what it is we have to offer as far as leadership, our culture, our experience, and work together within the community as a way of hope and experience and for everyone to understand. And so it's a very exciting partnership and opportunity that really has the Humanities Center has led. The event will take place on September 11th, a day that many of us, especially as veterans, really feel that we should be doing something, but what exactly it is we're doing. And so we're taking the opportunity to celebrate veterans. The Humanity Center has really stepped up and led this organization, and since we have partnered with many other organizations, individuals, and foundation, like the Veteran for Veterans Grants, individual partners that are also contributing to the financial ability to do this program, not just this year, but in ongoing years as well, in order to understand veterans as a culture.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. O'Fallon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. That's the short story of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and I'm happy to go into more depth at some point, but we're in the governor's budget with a slight increase that would support a little stronger use of our technology to reach across the state. You've seen that state map. Again, we are absolutely dedicated to the programs that connect people rather than divide us.
Mr. O'Fallon, one thing I would ask you is that with what you've been or would request or the governor's requested as an appropriation, do you have a history of leveraging the funds that you usually get from the state, or how does that work?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Yes, the Humanity Center has a long history of leveraging the funding, and in fact, as you can see in your handout, we actually have a physical center. Some of you have been to it. It's up by Lake Phelan. That center hosts many groups, veterans and nonprofits and colleges and universities and healthcare organizations and communities from all over the state. They pay a fee. So this is the seed corn, if you will. This state appropriation is the seed corn that allows us to compete for other grants. You saw that we have generated about $550,000 in other funds, grants, fees, and so forth. So, yes, we're very involved in leveraging the physical facilities and the seed corn funding.
Thank you. Any other questions? Now, thank you for your presentation. We appreciate it. Members, we'll be hearing budget recommendations from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Secretary of State, and the State Auditor on Thursday. If there's no other business, we'll look forward to seeing you then. Means adjourned.
Members.